Hello, and welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the series, Pat's Labor. No, I messed it up already.
Hey, yo, let's just roll with it. I think This should be a thing where part of the labor of Pat's Labor is eventually getting the intro right.
Yeah, we gave ourselves a tongue twister to start.
Yeah.
I'm Clayton Ashley.
I'm Tucson Egan.
And I'm Pat Labor. Welcome to the it's episode one of the pod. How we feeling?
Great,
excited,
ready to talk about these robots, ready to talk about labor history, ready to talk about the intersection between the police and the military, because that's here. That's a lot here in this episode.
Talk about a good anime. Like I knew it was legendary in certain respects, but like it's good, just fun watch. It's like an entertainment. It looks great. Can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, for people who missed episode zero, Clayton, you want to like give us a quick rundown of what and why this is?
What and why? So we're doing this podcast because I had an idea. It'd be funny to do a podcast called Pat's Apostrophe Labor about the series Pat Labor, which is a very famous anime series that is sometimes known as one of like the big three of mecha anime, and something that none of us have actually really seen entire way through, at least. And it was an opportunity to talk about labor history as well, because interestingly, this series is made by a collective of artists, very unusual in that industry. So it actually has that direct connection, but the show does explore the ideas of labor. Like there is a reason they call these things labors. And we're going to get started here in this first episode talking about the first episode of the original OVA. So it's going to get a little tricky because there's a TV series, two OVAs, and three movies that at some point we will cover in this series.
Also a manga, but we're not going to talk about that.
And a live action, but yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot. Like, hang on to your seat. We're driving this car as fast as we can.
So if you're watching or listening to this podcast and you want to know what we're talking about, it's a little tough. There is a Blu-ray collection out for a while of the show. This is one of those shows that is not super easy to access in the United States in a form that you paid for. But the episode that we're going to be talking about today, which is the first episode of Mobile Police Pat Labor, it's on YouTube. You can watch a dub of this episode on YouTube in relatively high quality if you just search for Pat Labor, the early days, episode one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what an episode one it is.
Yes.
Yeah. What is our title? What is this episode titled?
Second Unit Move Out.
This episode gets so quickly to what the heart of this giant robot anime is going to be, because it introduces, it introduces us to the term labor crime within the first 30 seconds, which is just such a wonderful turn of phrase.
Yep.
The basic premise of the world of Pat Labor is that it takes place in Japan, a modern Japan, now a retro future Japan, but what was at the time a projection into what, 1995 is the year?
It's 1998, and explicitly, like while I was watching this, it takes place in March of 1998 because the Special Vehicle Section Unit 2 has been around for 3 months. And they just got their first three actual patrol labors, like dedicated patrol labors that aren't just labor labors that have been like repainted to look like patrol labors and stuff like that. Yeah.
But in that little, like, it does sort of a slideshow style, like, here's the context for the entire series thing right at the start. And that explains that, labor crime came about because they had built giant robots to do physical labor, construction, moving to materials, what have you. And necessarily, to fight labor crime, you need custom built police patrol labors. And so it starts, and you might think, oh, action, robot cops, this is going to be an anime series. It's even got a great intro with an incredible song.
I want to talk about the song. I want to talk about the lyrics to this song. So, because when I was watching this and I was like reading the subtitles like along with it, I like picked out specific like lyrics that I wanted to talk about because it's so like relevant thematically. So it's called Maraiha Lovers or Futuristic Lovers by Hiroko Kasahara, right? And so I'm not going to read off all the lyrics, but I'm just going to read off the ones that really stuck out to me. You really threw a wrench into my works. We're futurists, you and me, technicians of love. The way I get flushed at the touch of your metal body, when I hold him tight, my Alphonse can do anything, anytime, anywhere, nothing's impossible. So that is literally a song that's sung from the perspective of Noah Izumi, who is one of the protagonists of the series, who is introduced in this first episode. And it made me stop in my tracks a little bit when it says we're futurists.
I know.
Because while like it's very interesting because it sort of signifies like that there is – this is around the time where the term futurist became sort of associated with technologists and scientists and like science fiction writers, right? People who are trying to imagine and build the future versus the initial iteration of that term, which is rooted in Italian futurism, which if you don't know, was an avant-garde art movement that inevitably sort of like dovetailed into fascism. Filippo Marinetti was a poet, and he wrote the Futurist Manifesto. And if you go and read the 11-point Futurist Manifesto, like if you just did that right now, look, all I would need to do is like copy paste that, open up 4chan, and paste it and paste it and paste it as green text. And no one could tell me the difference.
Wow.
No one could tell me the difference.
But like it's not that. It's not that in the lyrics of the
song. Not, it's not like that. No, it's firmly within the mode of the latter like form of like what people call futurists. But there is an uneasy tension given that iteration and its origin point. I digress.
Because I know this thing with like, yeah, I guess it was the 90s, I think, especially, but it was the 80s too, where they were... Some industries were turning to science fiction writers to kind of ask them about, like, strategically, what do you think a technology might be like in 10 years? Like, we're not actually looking for engineers to tell us this. I want somebody who's going to think about what are the, like, impacts of that and, you know, what sci-fi writers do. It's an interesting thing to think. Do they have actual expertise in that or not? You know, hard to say. But it's an interesting that it started around this time and sort of redefined the term a little bit.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that like this anime came out around like 1988, 1989, I believe. And it's like that's sort of towards the very end of the peak of the Japanese bubble economy. And like with labors, they are construction equipment that is used to then create and expand on this industry of technology that is happening. You have this company Shinohara Heavy Industries that is sort of like at the heart of the sort of like the labor phenomenon of creating these robots that has sort of like a pseudo monopoly on a lot of this stuff. And it's like it's very indicative of a very specific era of technology respective to Japanese culture.
There's that line in the opening. Can you tell me the lyrics to that opening again?
Yes, you really threw a wrench into my works.
Yes.
We're futurists, you and I, technicians of love.
Yes. Okay, so that ties into one of the themes that I've not seen this full show yet. I've only seen this first episode and one of the later movies. That idea of love and machines and wrenches is so central to this show because at the beginning of the show, we are on a not what looks kind of to me like a military base, but it's just an outdoor base. It's a hangar outside and there is a guy waiting.
It's on the outskirts of Japan.
There's a guy waiting by the road for something to show up. And that is the character Chief Sakaki, I believe.
Yeah, Old Man Sakaki.
And I love the way they introduce this character because he is like an old guy with, you know, sort of, you know, square jaw, He's got these glasses that sort of, you know, hood his eyes, sort of hide his feelings and his emotions a little bit. And he looks like he is going to be such a complete hard ass. And a character runs up to him and says, "Hey, the robots that we're waiting for, the pat labors that the delivery we're waiting for is running behind. I'm so," and then expresses his frustration that he's really bummed that these things are coming late because they really, 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 really want to start messing with these robots.
Yeah.
Really excited. And yeah.
In this moment of like really, really like cute, like vulnerability, Sakaki, still standing completely straight up, not nerding out at all, just says, like, "I completely agree with you. I want nothing more than to get access to these machines because I love machines and working on machines more than anything. Like, this is my life."
He calls himself a machine moron?
He's a machine moron, an outdated nuts and bolts kind of guy. His dad beat his ass for taking apart their foot warmer engine scooter when he was 12, and for 50 years, machines have been his life. And yes. I'm just like, yeah, I love that.
I really like it. He almost looks, just because I'm also revisiting the show, he almost looks like he stepped out of King of the Hill a little bit. Like, yeah. There's just something about him that is much like American General a little bit or something. I don't know, like...
For people who haven't like looked at the show yet, like one of the selling points, if I was trying to convince somebody to watch Pat Labor, is that it has an incredible cartooning style for these characters.
Yeah.
Where I think one of the negatives that people like bring up about anime sometimes is that a lot of characters can look very similar, right? Like if you're using the same eye shape for everybody, like the sort of standard eye shape, a sort of standard
physical body
shape.
Shapes too, even.
Yeah, and like so a lot of like the differentiation comes down to like hair and accessories and like, you know, color coding and stuff. Every character in this has a unique, you know, very cartooned expressive, like every character has the way their eyes look, the shape of their nose, the shape of their ears. It's like I don't know. I just really, really liked that. And that results in what you describe as sort of this sort of King of the Hill look.
Yeah.
Yes, so episode one, like we said, kicks off with this team that has been together for about 3 months. They are operating these labor robots as a police force to counter people who are using them to do crimes. And up to this point, they have been using modified units that were designed for labor. So essentially, they've been using policeified, you know, steamrollers and forklifts to go stop bank robbers and stuff who are using those tools. And this is the day that the specially designed labor models are arriving. But right away, the show gets into what I believe is going to be sort of the theme of the show, which is that there are bureaucratic realities that prevent these guys from like doing a Sentai pose and hopping into the robots and running around. And
there are infrastructural realities that preclude their ability to be able to dispatch because there's a fucking traffic jam happening in Japan. We can't get our shit in. And it's just like, we literally got like,
they're big robots. It's hard to move them.
Like, they're big robots. And like, there was like a bombing that happened and they had to send out the first unit for the special vehicles. And they're over there. And it's just like,
and also, it's 1998. People are calling each other on wired phones. It's not like, besides the fact there are giant robots, it really does feel like 1998. And that's also part of what makes the logistical reality of it feel even more, I don't know, real. Because it's not like there's not a lot of computer stuff going on in that.
So the team that's going to operate these Pat Labors has arrived ahead of the Labors themselves. And that results in this first episode sort of turning into a slice of life thing where it's a short story about a bunch of people waiting. And in the waiting for these robots to show up, that's the time that we get to learn about each of the characters who's going to be who we're going to be following for the rest of the series. And I wrote down their names.
I did too.
You want to take the lead on this too, Sam?
Yeah, sure. I sort of broke them apart into like, who I thought were sort of like the main characters and the supporting characters. And I'll go into that a little bit. Okay. So the main characters, pretty much from this first episode are Noah Izumi, who is, part of the special vehicles Unit two, right? Like, yeah, she's basically like the mascot, the closest thing to a mascot that Pat Labor has, other than like the actual Pat Labor itself, right?
Yes.
And she's like the forward, right? She's the person who's like piloting one of the Pat Labors. There's Asuma Shinohara, who is another recruit that is like her backup, right? And he is like the son of the Shinohara of Shinohara Heavy Industries, who makes the Pat Labors, but he's been sort of like tricked into becoming a public servant. That's sort of hinted at in this episode, right? You've got Shinobu Nagumo, who is the unit captain for the Special Vehicles Unit 1, Special Unit 1, the people who are dispatched, they're out there, they're doing the work, they're veterans, right? You got Kichi Goto, who is the Special Vehicles like Unit 2 captain, who is Noah and Asuma's like boss, right?
Yes.
He seems like kind of like a very laid back, very kind of lazy dude, but like as somebody who has watched like the movies, I'm gonna tell you, this guy, there's a lot more to this guy than meets the eye. Do not mistake his laziness for a lack of cunning. This
every
guy,
character, it felt like, oh, there's so much more here. Like,
yeah.
This is not just a light sketch as much as we're only getting a little bit in this episode.
Yeah.
And even those two captains are also kind of like, I'm not going to say on the outside, maybe are sort of mirror images of each other in terms of she's extremely professional.
Yes.
And
very professional, like, kind of assertive, aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he has like, and he like, you know, going back to the sort of cartooning thing, Goto, like his eyes tell you everything you need to know about him.
Yeah.
He always has a sort of like half-lidded, like unimpressed expression.
He's just like, he's just seen a lot of shit. And like, and he's just like, not this shit again. It's like, whatever. It's not like he doesn't care about his job. It's just like he just exerts the minimum amount of energy at all times in order to get it done. Because, like, when he actually needs to lock in, this dude knows how to make phone calls and make shit happen if he really, really needs to. There's, and so, like, getting into the supporting characters a little bit, there's Aizawa Oda, who is also on the Unit 2. He's kind of a blowhard. He's one of the new recruits. There is Mikitasu Shinshi, who is also another one of the new recruits and stuff. Like, and he's, like,
He's a wife guy,
and he also really likes cutting grass. I think he's really into it.
So like, I love that part where, like, so that the, one of the tasks that this team gets while they are waiting for the laborers to show up is a bunch of manual labor around the compound that they're going to be operating out of. And it was just such a beautiful scene of taking a bunch of characters, putting them in a field, and telling them their job is to cut grass, and then you get to learn a bit about each of their personalities.
By how they react to that job.
Yeah. By how they react to the labor.
You
have Oda there, the sort of blowhard you're talking about, and he's the character who most feels like he wants to be the protagonist of a different mecha anime.
Which is really great.
Good
way to put it.
And he's really impatient about it. But yeah, then the character we're talking about, Shinshi, is the character who I didn't have a good read on, but then seeing him in that scene where he's in the field of grass and he's just thinking about, like, doing a good job at this and like the methodical task of cutting this grass and how good it makes him feel. And it's like, okay, like I get this guy now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that there's a Hitomi Yamaza, who is like this big, just brick wall of a man. And he's actually just a huge softy. He makes his own lunch
and he's a little hot dog octopus.
And he's just a nice guy.
If he was in an anime today, he'd be a himbo.
He's basically like a proto himbo in this universe. Yeah. And then you have like aforementioned old man Sakaki, and you have Shijio Shiba, who is like Sakaki's like right hand man, like the second chief mechanic, like the second in command chief mechanic of like Special Vehicles Unit. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And to back up to the first character we introduced, Noah Izumi. Her attitude is interesting because we have these sort of gearhead characters, Goto and Sakaki, Sakaki and his second in command, whose job it is to keep these robots running. And out of all of the pilots or officers who are going to be working with him, Noah Izumi has the most emotional attachment to the machines.
Yeah.
Not from the same perspective that like Goto does, where he's like, I need to get in there and see how they work. but Izumi looks at them and sees living things, essentially. Yeah. She's like, she gives them names.
She nicknamed hers before she met her Pat Labor. Yeah.
So that's your basic cast of characters.
And I think we were just actually in the scene where they're like sitting down for lunch. I think that was when we got our octopus hot dogs. But
yeah.
the next scene is one of these ones. I think we've even kind of like hyped it in a way for how much is an example of bureaucratic
yes.
procedure being such a focus of this series, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. And so we get our captain, Goto, and I think it's Ota. And yeah, we said he's a hothead. He is so excited to shoot guns. Mm-hmm. He wants to shoot that big robot gun. And who can, right. you know, it's almost like, I feel like there's almost maybe a little bit of the anime fan is in this character a little bit. I don't know doing something quite that meta yet, but it's, there's like, of course he wants to shoot the big robot gun, but Goto goes through the fact that in order to do that, you'll have to file paperwork to get the bullets. And the bullets, well, those are expensive when you only get so many to each team. So that rounds out to about one session of shooting practice per year.
Per year.
And that's only if you can get through all the red tape.
Yeah.
And he's saying this with this like great profile shot of Goto and like the four in the like right up in front. His that like we said, his head, all their heads are pretty distinct. And so you're getting him just like, this is boring, but rote, and he knows all of it. Like, as much as this is the first instinct that you get that, like, maybe he's lazy, but he knows his shit, and mm-hmm. that's why he knows this all to heart. And it's just like, huh, you wanna shoot a gun? Are you sure?
Yeah.
His sort of, like, apparently, like, lazy demeanor, like, this is the moment you sort of realize that, like, it's... No, he just understands how to move at the pace of the system he exists within.
Yeah. Yes, that's the perfect way of putting it. Yes, absolutely. And, like, he's just like... what is it? It's Oda who's just like, so what am I supposed to do? It's just like, and then Goda is just like, you do what everyone else does. You avoid bullets and target practice, and you have to. You do it in one shot. That's the way it is for soldiers and cops here in Japan. And this is what I wanted to circle back on. I talked about this right at the top of this episode, that before this, when they first show up at the beginning of the episode, you've got Asuma Shinohara, mm-hmm. who is like, this kind of reminds me of like one movie that I saw where like this, like, he just goes on this whole tangent, and then Oda is like, it's not like that at all. It's different. They're the cops. And then like Azuma is just like, cops in the army are both have ranks and guns. What's the difference? And boy, is that an interesting, observation on part of Asuma's part, especially given the fact that while it's not spelled out, it becomes more clear like in like later sort of installments of Pat Labor, or at least the movies that I've seen, that this universe of Pat Labor exists in the universe where, you know, World War II happened, mm-hmm. and there's Article 9, which says that Japan can't have a standing army. Mm-hmm. They can have a self-defense force. And so, like, that tension between, like a militarized, like, force.
Versus
a domestic peacekeeping force. That is already sort of, like... The tension there is already kind of apparent. It's like, it's very interesting as to whether or not these two entities in their complicated nature are sort of convergent in some ways for the fact of there being a giant fucking robot you have to put into.
This transitions nicely into our labor point.
This is Pat's labor.
And now here's where I want to reinforce one of the underlying principles of Pat's labor. Is this is not necessarily me teaching about labor. This is me learning about labor. And this is a case where I am really learning. So I'm gonna acknowledge that I don't know a lot about Japanese labor history. I don't know a lot about American labor history. And a thing that I'm excited to learn more about is that stuff. So I'm gonna share like sources here and what I'm mm-hmm. learning. The thing that I'm thinking about this week, I stumbled across a paper on JSTOR. Let me read you the name of it. The Origin of One-Party Domination, America's Reverse Course, and the Emergence of the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan. Specifically talking about the time period of Reconstruction and occupation after World War II, because it occurred to me as I got online, I Googled labor movements in Japan, and it was like, oh, of course, the time period where the United States was occupying Japan following World War II would have had a really, really, really big impact on the attitude towards labor and policing that we're going to see in this anime series.
Yeah. Just to dip in here real quick, yeah. Just like the fact is, like, we didn't mention who is directing this OVA, yes. Which is Mamoru Oshii. Mamoru Oshii is one of the core members of Headgear, which is the basically the consortium of writers and artists who basically own the Pat Labor property. They co-create the Pat Labor property. They basically just like decide on what projects as a sort of committee of sorts as to what happens, right? He was the last person to be sort of like join it. And he was born in 1951, and towards the end of the 1950s, the 1960s, he began to become involved in the student protest movement that was going on at that time, which was very much sort of like situated around what was called the AMPO protests, right? He would hand out pamphlets and stuff like that. And so he was...
So the AMPO protest, to clarify, it was about the automatic renewal of the treaty that allowed the U.S. to continue having military bases on Japanese soil.
Yeah.
And some more left-leaning... more left-leaning parties in Japan wanted to move to a more neutral position in the what was setting out to become the Cold War, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily want to be a forward operating base for America in this Cold War. That's what the protests were leading up to.
Because if you have like Article 9 that says that Japan can't have a standing army, they can have a self-defense force, and then that self-defense force... it's effectively being like leased out, like their territory is being leased out to the American military as a forward operating base. And sometimes the self-defense force is being used by the UN. Like, so we're not allowed to have our own army, but we're basically an army on lease to like other sorts of like ideologies and stuff. And that sort of infringes on their autonomy and their sense of self. And it was just like, yeah,
but I thought Japan was a democracy and that they could elect the party that they wanted to elect.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Clayton. So before we move on, I want to credit the author of this paper, Young Wook Lee. From like what I'm learning here, like there was something of a reverse course in the democratization and sort of westernization. Or no, it wasn't a reverse course on westernization, but it was definitely a reverse course on the sort of flattening of Japanese society following the occupation. So initially when the occupation started, there were a lot of reforms introduced by the U.S. government and the governing boards under, Japanese representatives that felt kind of New Deal. There was the breakup of the Zaibatsus, right? So the Zaibatsus were these, massive conglomerates, which in addition to being massively overpowered, sort of monopolizing
family
economic forces,
down,
were also so, family-based. Yeah. Right, yes. So
breaking up nepotistic, like, monopolies? What a concept!
Yeah. What a concept!
We have the breakup of the Zaibatsus as well as other antitrust operations. We have explicit personhood and rights for women. Mm-hmm. We have, related to the show, we have the decentralization of police to sort of make that less of a more of a local operation and less of a central, government police going out and policing people. And very importantly, we have the right to strike. The right to organize and strike.
This is the late 1940s, right?
This is the late 1940s. This is the 4 years following.
And if I'm not mistaken, this is a brief period where, you could say by virtue of who they elected, they are in support of this because Japan had a socialist prime minister.
That's right.
In the late 1940s.
They had the JSP. But then came the reverse course, which I think sort of pushes us towards the story or the vibes of Pat Labor. As this growth starts happening, or as this reconstruction starts happening, the Cold War is also ramping up. And this paper that I was reading is about determining why that reverse course happened, and I don't have a clear answer. But the factors at play were that the United States started to get a little more nervous about communism. Yeah. So after explicitly, like, allowing communism, the Communist Party to exist again, they get a little more strict. There is a strike planned in 1947, a general labor strike planned in 1947 that General MacArthur says, no, you can't actually do that. And then there is a Red Purge in 49 through 50, where about 22,000 people lose their jobs, sort of get internally exiled. And those were mostly left-wing union activists. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so essentially they come in, change a bunch of stuff, then sees how some of that stuff is sort of shifting slightly towards socialism, communism, and would potentially inhibit the economic growth that they want to see, and how that economic growth would then serve them as a partner, and say, okay, actually, we're not going to do some of this stuff.
You can unionize. No, not like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, more or less. So labor union membership peaked in 1949 at 55%, and since then has fallen to 16 these days.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds
yeah.
familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of student activists at that time. It's like, I was looking up, speaking of articles, like I was doing a little bit of research, you know, about, you know, Mamoru Oshii and stuff. And I came across mm-hmm. this article by Animation Obsessive, which is basically like a group of like animation, like enthusiasts and scholars who like do like some of the best, like specialist, like writing about world animation as a whole. Right. And there's this article from October 10th, 2021. This was during the IATSE strike. And they talk about Hayao Miyazaki, union man, right? And they talk about how, wow. like, while Miyazaki was not a part of, like, the, like, a print, like, really a part of, like, the AMPO protest, he did end up becoming, like, the general secretary of Toei Animation's, like union animators union at that time in 1964. That's wow. how he met Aizawa Takahata, who would go on to be one of the three co-founders of Studio Ghibli because he was the vice president of the union at the time. Mm. Their politics were far to the left. Miyazaki was a Marxist with an affinity for Maoist China. While he later drifted away from Marx and Mao, he stayed strongly progressive. Takahata was a Marxist for life, and during the Vietnam War, Miyazaki said that he and his friends were rooting for the Viet Cong. And in the comments of this, like, they're sort of talking about it back and forth, and Animation Obsessive sort of mentions, like, you'll find animators across the political spectrum all around the world. Many Japanese animators from Miyazaki and Takahata's generation were on the left. By contrast, right? Mm-hmm. While Mamoru Oshii was part of the AMPO protests, right, pushing against this sort of incursion, right, Mamoru Oshii, who's a bit younger than Miyazaki, has put nationalistic themes in some of his work, and mm-hmm. he's come out in support of repealing Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, a position right. which Miyazaki himself is strongly, strongly against. And I think that, you know, when you see it sort of like that, it's like, it's not necessarily that. When I read something like that, I don't think it's necessarily that Oshii wants there to be a standing army. He wants that decision to be left up to the Japanese people and not by this article that was co-written by America, like, as to what they can do. It's like he wants that decision to lay directly within, like, Japan itself. But yeah, very, very interesting. Also, a side note, Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, the character designer of Evangelion and Summer Wars, has expressed extreme right-wing views in recent years. So, fun fact.
Yeah, it comes up.
Wait, sorry, who is that?
Yoshiyuki Sadamoto, who is the character designer of Evangelion and Summer Wars. And I don't know what that means by extreme right-wing views, but I really don't want to find out because I like Evangelion. Yeah. I'd like
boy,
to just...
It's crazy when you... like learning that the Dragon Quest composer guy, this like ancient old man who makes these like little happy marching songs.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hey, let's, oh, huh. How come he's weighing in on that particular? Oh, okay. That's how he feels about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not like a, it's not like a straightforward thing here because of the fact that it's like, is it good or bad to have an army, but is it good or bad to have another country telling you what to do so explicitly?
Exactly.
And now we're even in like, I mean, now there's sort of a thing of like, well, the argument is that we don't have an army because that other country will protect us.
Yeah. Yeah. Will they?
Like,
yeah.
So it's getting even more complicated and it's not so clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
What those terms mean in Japan's context.
Yeah. Miyazaki is a pacifist. He's an avowed progressive and pacifist who just like, I don't want anyone to have an army. I don't really want there to be armies. I understand there's violence, but it's just like, if we can choose, like, why are we doing this?
Also, airplanes are really, really cool. Please don't use them for war.
That's the inherent tension in that too. Cause he loves military, like, machinery, just because he loves how it moves, he loves looking at it, he thinks it's cool, but then he also has to sort of reckon with the fact that, like, you know, these are weapons of violence and destruction, something that he has engaged with in his own work through films like The Wind Rises, or even with Howl's Moving Castle to some degree. I digress. But we're talking, we're just talking about, you know, the intersection between Japanese politics and anime, you know.
So do we think Oshii likes cops?
That's a good question. That's a really, really good question. You know, like, what? Man, you are really expanding my mind right now, because, like, he actually deals with cops in a lot of different ways. Like, he deals with, in Ghost in the Shell, just purely by dint of the fact that, you know, like, Public Security Section 9 is technically, like, a hostage rescue SWAT force. In a cyberpunk, advanced cyberpunk world. And then you have like properties like the Kirabara Saga, which basically deals with like sort of like a militant, all but fascist world, where you have like these guys in black armor and like red lenses or whatever, basically mowing down like protesters and like militarized protesters, but still protesters. And I'm just it's like, that's a good question. Pat, what do you think?
So, like, again, it's very hard to grow up in America and then watch Japanese show about policing and necessarily see the apply the same mindset to
it.
The general tone of it is that, like, yes, we are meant to strongly relate to these characters, and they are generally, they're good people, and
these are not just protagonists. They are coded as being fallible, stupid, idiotic, but relatively heroes.
And also people archetypes you've seen in all your workplaces. Like, even if you didn't work cops, you kind of had like the lazy guy who works just as fast as he possibly can.
Yeah.
The person who's really professional, the person who finds the beauty in every little work they do. Like, that's just kind of common but just how people approach work.
I was just watching this and I was just like, it feels like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but a little bit, but with mechas. And
it's workplace comedy at its heart.
It's a workplace law enforcement comedy. That's really what it is.
And it's being produced in a country where, like, statistically, the police kill a lot less people.
They're not armed.
And within the show,
as far as I understand it.
Within the show, like, they, so far, and within, when this first episode eventually gets to the giant robot part, they don't kill anyone, right? They stop the robot that the bad guys are using, and then they arrest it.
Did anyone else count how many shots Oda shot at that robot before he got his shit wrecked? Like, I'm thinking back to like how much they Goda says like bullets are this big. They cost this much. Avoid using bullets. Take them down if you have to. And if you have to do it with one shot or whatever. And this dude sprays and prays for like five rounds out of that revolver. That makes like 5 out of 6 rounds. How much does that shit cost? Like, is that coming out? Whose taxes is that coming out of? I want to know that shit.
And he doesn't only miss with every shot. He does a lot of friendly fire.
Oh my God.
He flips over a lot of his own teammates' police cars and shit. So when this episode eventually does get to the action part, there is a robbery downtown. Mm-hmm. And there is a big rogue labor running around making a mess of things, and they need to stop it. So the strategy that they come up with is they have to drive out in small vehicles, scooters and stuff, to get out to the place where their cars are in the traffic, or their labors are stuck in the traffic jam waiting to get delivered, and launch them from the beds of those trucks.
Just gotta get that shit out of there.
So I'm trying to remember this, I think this is the one scene that happens before this that's kind of interesting, which is I think it's Noah, Azumi, and Asuma Shinohara. It's kind of them getting to know each other a bit more. I think this is where he reveals that he is the son of that company. But I also just wanted
not
to point out.
Not voluntarily, though. Yeah. Like, it's just her connecting the dots between his last name and the name that happens to be on one of the bat labors.
Exactly. One of the, like, you know, literally labors the police have painted. But
yeah.
I just wanted to also point out this scene because it's another example of, like, how beautiful the cell animation looks, because it's like mostly in darkness and shadow when they go into this big warehouse to like look at the other labors. And you can also compare that even to some of the other shots that are just, they're mostly still, maybe they're just doing some of that like parallax of three different layers.
Yep.
But I like, it's a treat to watch this on Blu-ray on like a nice TV. It's so rich and detailed. You can see the hand craftedness of it. That's just a thing I want to note. This is a really good looking show.
Yeah.
And so back to the sort of idea of does Oshii like cops? Is he getting off on this? It doesn't feel like that kind of show to me so far, because a lot of like police media from the 80s and 90s in the United States was really, I mean, even back to the 70s, mm-hmm. was really based on the idea that rules that make police officers slow down are bad.
Yeah, they get in the way of getting the criminals.
The dirty hairification, the dirty hairification of police media, yeah.
Right, it's just so like the tone of the film is that the moment that the good guy says, fuck the rules, I'm going to kill whoever I want, is the heroic moment, right? This doesn't feel like that so far. The character who is extremely enthusiastic to shoot his gun a bunch fucks up really bad.
Yeah.
I know he's an idiot, but he's been your partner for a day. Avenge him. That's literally what Asuma tells Noah.
Mm-hmm. He gets his shit wrecked. He's fine. He doesn't die. The robot knocks his block off.
Did we mention this other labor? I'm really just excited because as little as this show is about robots doing stuff, I'm excited by how different this robot looks. Like I assumed that all the labors are going to be basically bipedal humanoid things, but this is a tripod with wheels on each of the legs instead of like walking. And then like
it looks sort of like a virus under a microscope.
Yes,
that's a good comparison. Yeah. And so it's very fast because it's rolling. Mm-hmm. And then it's like hopping every once in a while to move, like to be more agile. It's got one laser or gun or something on the top of it. So it is not humanoid. This one is not like they're not trying to do any sort of anthropomorphization with it. It's a device. It's much more mechanical looking, and so it's, you know, it's, and it's bright red, so it's like it's got threat to it. It's really animated well. It you know, it blows up some squad cars as Oda fails, like you said, he says turn your fear into rage and crush the tripod with the fist of justice.
Yeah. Just like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude?
Yeah.
And that fight scene pretty much just ends up it's just as simple as, what's the character's name?
Noah.
Azumi?
Yeah.
Noah, yeah.
Yeah, Noah just like uses her now detached like Pat Labor arm and throws it at the.
Right. We missed that. So it also hits her, or does he? Is it friendly fire that she loses her arm?
Like no, the robot hits her. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So when it gets past Oda, it takes her arm, but she's running after it, holding her other arm. Now, what's the thing here? I'm trying to remember. There's a museum that it's like about to shoot or something.
Yeah, it's holding a museum hostage. So their plan is to rout because again, this is a show about logistics and minimizing damage. Their plan isn't just to go fight the robot. It is to corral the robot into a park where they can take care of it without doing a lot of damage or hurting a lot of civilians around it.
Yep.
So they successfully rout this labor into the park. And that park also contains a museum that has a bunch of like historical art in it. And when the hijackers realize what's going on, they start threatening this museum. Like, okay, well, we're going to blow up this museum if you don't let us go.
Wait, critically, I remember now. It's because they ran out of gas.
Yeah, you're
robot
right.
Ran out of gas, so now they're like desperate, and they're like,
oh. Yeah.
Another thing here, which I think is accurate, is the criminals are not typically thinking things out very well. They're desperate often. So it's like, you don't need to portray every criminal as some kind of like mastermind with a plan. They were in over their head. They ran out of gas. They don't know what to do. And so they're like, we'll destroy this museum if you don't let us go.
I love how Gota is such like an integral part of this plan because he's the one who's like calling in favors in order to like finagle all this stuff. Like when they threaten to blow up the museum, Shinobu, like Nagumo is like, she is just like, no. And then Gota's just like, they're bluffing. And like earlier on when they're talking about how they're actually going to go about the actual route, I can't remember the specific names of it, but like at some point, Asuma is just like, wait, shouldn't we just like navigate them through here instead of there? And like Gota's just like, no. And I'm just like, well, why? And it's like, because this other place is where I grew up. I don't want to risk any like damage to this area, so we're gonna go through this area. It's so funny.
I forgot about that.
It's so funny, yeah.
There's also, I think with the plan, there's a little bit of the captain's like, I wouldn't say it's like a rivalry. It's not like a hugely political dynamic, but there is something about like, originally I think the plan was to get what team one was like diverting it so team two could take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan is going awry. So, you know, heroically, Team One ends up taking care of it because of the fist of justice.
Yep.
As they're, you know, running out of ideas, how do we stop this? I mean, Izumi just literally throws the other arm at them and shouts, it's the fist of justice. Or wait, maybe I just wrote that down. Did she say it?
I can't remember off the top of my head. I just know that she threw her arm and then it pans to like a large establishing shot. And then it's just like, and that is sort of like the climax of that fight. We're left to assume that they won, they were able to defeat them. And then at the end, like, Nagumo is sort of like, she's trying to like, you know, like broker some type of like peace with Gota.
Yes.
But then it's just like, then they have this sort of like tit for tat where like Gota's just like, do you want the fat labors? I mean,
yeah, for your then Nagumo's better, like, more experienced team.
I'm just
or something.
Like, yeah. And then Gota's like, too bad. It's like that's what headquarters can't have them, like headquarters gave them to us, so that's what's gonna be.
That's the first episode of Pat Labor. I really liked it.
It's
was my
time.
First it was my first time seeing the show, and I was just really pleasantly surprised with how funny it was, how human all of the characters are.
Immediately, like right off the bat,
right.
I liked them all.
Yeah, very. This show doesn't have a Guts Berserk who's like,
nope,
like a, you know, an awful guy, and we're waiting to like finally see the humanity in this character. Like a lot of anime starts off with a deeply unlikable person who you then start.
My
to
power
like.
Is anger.
Yeah.
My power is incredible rage. Like no, nobody like that yet. Not yet, I guess.
Just a bunch of people doing jobs in a unfantastical way, but it's still really charming.
And great to look at.
Really nice to look at.
Our plan will be to continue with episode 2 of that first OVA. Also just want to say thank you for being here, especially if you have subscribed to Rogue. You can check out tons of cool stuff written there by our pals I think we're even going to have some cool freelance stuff as this first week of launch is going.
Yeah.
So look out for that. And we will have some bonus stuff for y'all. I think we mentioned there is an episode zero if you want to get some more like context for the show and our, I don't know, field of anime knowledge. We had a fun time doing that.
It's very rough.
Yeah.
It's very, I will say that for myself. It's very rough. I'm literally just kicking a bunch of like, just dumping out
incredible
whatever knowledge.
Facts off the top of your head.
It's like, I'm just dumping it out of the top of my head. It's like, oh man, I wish I prepared. It's like, I wish I organized all this stuff. Meanwhile, I'm dumping like a library's worth of like anime minutia onto you.
I'm so glad you have it. Yeah. One of us needs to be, I mean, two of us need to be not fucking idiots.
hey.
Should we do this? Should we talk about non-pat labor anime stuff at the end?
Oh, man.
So hold on. Let's wrap the podcast and we'll keep this for the video section.
Yes, extra
bonus content. So
yes.
For Pat's Labor of Rogue, this is Clayton Ashley.
Tucson Egan.
Pat Gill.
Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.